listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
It was way back when, I think in the late 60s, that a certain magazine came out. It also kind of spun off to a radio show and a live touring show, which eventually became Saturday Night Live. There were movies, Animal House, Caddyshack, that sort of stuff. It was called National Lampoon, and it was funny. It was really funny. It was also a little dirty, little smutty, little irreverent. And we have some of the guys here with us tonight who made it actually happen, who are responsible for that thing that no longer exists. One of whom is Rick. And Rick, he believes, and it's quite possibly true, that he is the most prolific contributor of illustrated articles to the National Lampoon magazine ever. He's painted the poster for Animal House and was the creator of the magazine's trademark visual, the Mona Gorilla, which I think you'll probably see up here at some point. Shortly after 9/11, Rick and the illustrious Myra Coleman created the most talked about New Yorker cover of the century, New Yorkistan. They also just completed a sub-culinary map of Manhattan, parroting the New York City subway system map for none other than the New Yorker, that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority of New York will probably sue them over. Rick is the mastermind behind the new book that blows the cover off one of the funniest and best kept of our nation's secrets. And that book is Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, The Writers and Artists Who Made the National Lampoon Insanely Great. Fresh from a tour of the Bay Area, including a stop at a location in Cupertino, California, where certain products are made that bear the name of a popular fruit you may have heard of, apple. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's it'll be a conversation. It'll be a part slideshow, part tour, trip down memory lane, trip in reminiscing and telling the history of the magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, we will also have a Q&A afterwards, so wait for the mic. Raise your hand. Wait for the mic. It'll come to you. Talk into it. We record for podcasts. It's important that you wait for the mic. Ladies and gentlemen, no waiting anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, Rick Meyerowitz.
Justin, did you call our names? Did you? Oh, that was it. That was our cue. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming on this crappy night. It won't be crappy inside here. I was surprised by the weather in Los Angeles. I'm not going to make weather jokes. But anyway, we're here. These gentlemen are with me. This is Ellis Wiener and Chris Kelly and Ted Mann. It's all illustrious Angelenos, but once from other places, like Canada, which is really another place. Anyway, we're here. I did this book. This is so much smaller than the book up there, but it's heavier, because after all, light is ephemeral. So I am going to talk for a little while, and then we're going to have what we hope will be a conversation. And I want to tell you a little bit about the Lampoon, what it is, what it was. It is nothing right now, but what it was a different thing. And I'm going to have to, even though this is in 244-point type, I'm going to put on my glasses.
Rick, I think it's something because they still have the college sex movie that comes out on video.
Every 2 weeks. And yeah, there is something. There is an entity that owns the National Lampoon brand, but they are forbidden from publishing a magazine. The Harvard Lampoon has taken the rights back. The Harvard Lampoon, which licenses the name, has taken the rights.
The chairman is currently incarcerated
The chairman, president of the current Lampoon, is currently incarcerated. A magazine hasn't been published for 20 years. So here's the book. And in July of 1969, at the same time that NASA launched three men to the moon, Henry Beard, Doug Kenny, and Rob Hoffman arrived in New York City to start a national humor magazine. And I always think, well, why not? How hard can that be? They were the kind of prodigies who make other prodigies appear incompetent. At the Harvard Lampoon, they had edited parodies of Time and Life magazines, which were bestsellers. And Beard and Kenny had written Board of the Rings, a parody of Lord of the Rings, which is still churning money into the coffers, and they have coffers, at the Harvard Lampoon. And it had sold, when they came to the National Lampoon, to found the National Lampoon, Board of the Rings had sold 750,000 copies. And it was only in paperback. They formed a partnership with a publisher in New York. They consulted experts in the field who advised them to drop the whole business. A humor magazine would never work. They conferred with mentors who counseled caution. They acquired a mad commune of underground art directors, and they hired a staff, smoked odd substances, and they drew to them like-minded and almost equally brilliant writers and artists who all wanted to change the world or blow it up or both. And somehow, in April of 1970, they published a magazine called The National Lampoon. Doug Kenny, our friend Doug, who we all love, had Joe College good looks and shoulder blade length blonde hair. He would have been the natural leader of the Lampoon's group of writers and artists, except that this group, including him, was the kind of group that wanted all natural leaders dead. And he was a terrible editor, given to remarks like, "This sucks, but I don't know why." It's not what you're looking for in an editor. But he had other things. This was written by an English editor at the Lampoon, Tony Hendry. He says, "In the first moments after I met Kenny, he informed me that all British humor was totally unfunny. Moments later, he was improvising flawlessly in the manner of Thackeray. And I mean Thackeray, not Trollope or Mrs. Gaskell or Dickens. And moments after that, he was demonstrating that he could put his entire fist into his mouth." And that probably is the conundrum of Doug Kenny. What did he do with his fist once he got it in there? And this was not going to be your old Mad magazine. It took a few issues, but the magazine caught fire. It just kind of foundered a little bit. It's kind of iffy art direction, but then it really caught fire, and not from the shoebox of sweating dynamite that someone once sent an editor that caused the evacuation of the entire office building at 635 Madison Avenue. It was an electric place to work. It had the feeling of a rogue enterprise. By the way, this is Henry Beard. You like the picture of Doug with his hand in his mouth? We'll go back to that. It really did have the feeling of a rogue enterprise. The competition to top each other was fierce. You could feel the energy in the air, and I swear you could hear the synapses of some of the funniest minds of that generation firing like broadsides from a pirate ship. And I always think of these guys as pirates. A mix of, but not that kind of pirate, the raping and just the pillaging kind. A mix of writers and artists would attend the regular editorial meetings, and if it was organized in advance, Henry or Doug would lead the meeting at a huge oval table. If it hadn't been organized and was, as often happened, disorganized, the meeting would take place on the run from office to office, and to me resemble a crowd of drunken guests at a barbecue having a yelling contest. It was a comedy slam, insult fest, humor decathlon that energized everybody who took part in it. And that kind of thing can wear you out. After 5 years, Henry and Doug were no longer young. They were instead 28 years old. And so they cashed out and they took their scads of money and they ran. And so we're going to look at some images from the story of the Lampoon. Now, this is Henry Beard in his office. Here's a Lampoon cover. And the Lampoon was an equal opportunity offender. They were lucky enough to have 16 years of Republican presidents during the 20 years they published a magazine. So, and everybody is lucky to have Richard Nixon as president if you're doing a magazine. And he was a great source of humor and work to all of us. And of course, that's Kissinger on the end of his nose. But it wasn't just Nixon that came in for it. Here's something from the news of the month. It's the choice of the century. It was 1972 when they were running against each other. Nixon says, vote for me. I'll finish packing the Supreme Court with narrow-minded nebbishes. I'll repeal the rest of the Bill of Rights, and I'll make Indochina look like the bottom of a shake and bake bag. And can you read what this says? Can you see it? I have the economic know-how of a Bulgarian shoe factory manager, the grasp of world affairs of a Bolivian civics teacher, and the decisiveness of a bed of kelp. And this is Henry Beard at his best in a few sentences describing these two guys. And while we're on Nixon, here's Nixon having a phone conversation with his Secretary of Transportation, Claude Brinegar, who's in telling him that Secretary Rogers is disloyal. And Nixon says, I'm glad you drew my attention to this matter, Claude. Farting goddamn hell, pissed damn. I'm going to cold cock that fucking bastard. So, and to me, that sounds just like Nixon. And Henry was right on in the way he got the language and the way he understood who this character was. This is from a larger story called Constitutional Comics. It was a 10-page comic book that dealt with real constitutional issues, which I'm sure you'd love to hear about. So there were people that were revered on the left. One of them was Che. And here he is getting a pie in the face from the National Lampoon in January of 72. And this cover upset a lot of people in the counterculture because they thought we were on their side. And there were no sides at the Lampoon. The Lampoon attacked hypocrisy and stupidity wherever we found it. And one of the foremost attackers was Michael O'Donoghue. He has four Michael O'Donoghues in his office in 1971. Michael said this, making people laugh is the lowest form of humor. He believed that humor should perhaps hurt a little bit. And one of his first covers was this thing, which has Chinese, perhaps he's Korean, but I think he's Chinese, and they're gunning down Santa. And just the notion of Santa getting shot is the kind of thing that would make me feel gleeful and happy. And it must have touched a chord in the public because they began to buy this magazine in droves. And then this cover. You know, it's very light in here. What do you think? It's not hot in here, Justin, but maybe it's a little light. Could we turn down the lights a little bit? Maybe you could see this a little better. I can see fine. And of course, the next issue, and I don't know who wrote it, Ted, but it could have been you, in the editorial in the next issue, it said, not enough of you bought the magazine. So we had to, And of course, Hitler is always good for a laugh. And of course, Mel Brooks has made a great career doing Hitler jokes. But this was a cover for the Escape issue, and it had a great article about how Hitler was enjoying his retirement on a beautiful little island in the South Pacific. They found an actor he was an acrobat from Austria. His name was Billy Frick, and he had played Hitler in Is Paris Burning? And he was living in retirement in Naples, Florida. And he arrived in Martinique for the photo shoot with his Hitler outfits. He had two Hitler suits, but he he refused to put the Hitler suits on and pose for photographs until he got cash. Hitler was demanding cash before he would pose. Michael O'Donoghue did the Vietnamese baby book, which many people say is their the piece in the Lampoon that they remember the most. And of course, baby's first wound, baby's first bandage, baby's first toy, piece of shrapnel. And this book caused a lot of people to cancel their subscriptions and be angry with the Lampoon, but it also made a statement about what was going on in Vietnam and what the war was like. And it has some power to take a form like that, an innocuous thing such as a baby book, and make it into this this attack on the war. And then there was this, the... humor should hurt a little bit. And you know the story about this. The exceptional part of this is the magazine was sued for $11 million by Volkswagen. Because, not because they showed the car floating, because the Volkswagen people said, yes, it could. The bottom was sealed. Not because of the headline insulting Ted Kennedy, because possibly it was true. They sued for $11 million because the Lampoon art director had failed to change their logo. And the solution for it was they settled out of court, and the Lampoon had to razor this out of any issues that hadn't already been sold, which was a non-event because all the issues had already been sold. This is Michael's conception of the Sistine Chapel floor. Everybody knows the ceiling. It's kind of boring, all those people, you know, and like that, and the whole touching hands and stuff, the floor. So I went to the Sistine Chapel for the first time about a year after this painting was done and appeared in the Lampoon. And the first thing I did is look at the floor. No cigarette butts. Something from Michael's How to Write Good. Michael O'Donoghue's How to Write Good. It's not for us. It's a nice idea, Jim, he says, but frankly, you write like a moron. George Tro, the great George Tro, who came to the Lampoon from Harvard and left the Lampoon to go to the New Yorker and had a career of 20 years at the New Yorker, did a wonderful kind of writing, a mixing of the rapier wordplay of Henry Beard and the good-hearted humor of Douglas Kenny, and he was just an amazing guy, and this is one of my favorite pieces of his. It's Learn Euphemism, the Language of Evasion. It says, tired of saying what you mean? I'm tired of saying what I mean. I want to escape. Help me learn euphemism. And it's it says, if you play your cards right, you need never face the most treacherous words in our mother tongue again: Jew, rich, homosexual, dead, and frankly. Learn euphemism, the only language endorsed by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, as well as three leading Midwestern universities, and will tell you how to avoid these dread words, even when talking to or about Marcel Proust. This is... And the first line, of course, is, you're a Jew, aren't you, Mary? John Weidman, who did this piece, the bar exam of the state of New York. And, of course, the bar exam was an easy test if you were white and not an easy test if you weren't. And so when you open it up, it says, the first thing it says is, shh, don't tell anyone. You're one of the 67% who is going to pass this test today. Just sit back, try and look busy, but don't worry about a thing. You went to Yale, didn't you? You're in. And see those people from minority groups in the room working so hard, answering questions that aren't on the exam we gave you? Anyway, it's a wonderful thing. And it shows the level of curiosity and the range of interest of the people at the Lampoon that they would parody the bar exam, that they had the nerve to even think of it. That's me. I didn't do this. See, I had hair. I didn't do this. I like this, but I didn't do it. I did this, the Mona Gorilla. And we all, she's looking a little black and greasy up there, but age will do that to you. I kind of like it, and sometimes I think I probably owe debt to Leonardo, but he probably gets more credit than he deserves these days, so I'll keep what I can get. And by the way, Michael Pollan would like this. She's got a piece of fruit. It just occurred to me. And, you know, you have to go back. Where's the fruit? Mona Gorilla. I did a lot of caricatures for the National Lampoon. This is the Ayatollah. He's reading the Iran report on the Iran-Contra affair. This is, I thought we needed at least one Ronald Reagan. This is from the Birds of Washington. And he's a wattle-throated booby. And he's being, in the background is his mate, the shrieking red virago. It's, and I was drawing Reagan, and it occurred to me all that stuff would just be dripping down. Well, anyway, there he is, governor. I thought I'd show it, and I did this, looking kind of green. Tony Hendra was at the Lampoon for a number of years. Tony did this comic book, Dragula, Queen of Darkness. He was a hemosexual. This cartoon of this woman, which appears in the book, for those of you who want to buy a book because there's a cartoon of this woman in it, this woman is the reason why Costco isn't carrying this book. The Costco buyer opened it up, turned a couple of pages, said, uh-oh, what do you have next? He said, this is what was told to me by my publisher. And I don't know, she seems kind of tame to me considering the stuff that they're probably selling there. Wade Wadler's magazine. Sam Gross, the great cartoonist, worked for the National Lampoon. Maybe you're familiar with this cartoon. Does this cartoon have a caption, or does it have no caption? It's hard to know. Sam, he says, hey, what exposure are you using? Look at her face, how great it is. Sam is has worked for the Lampoon for almost 20 years, and his career now is at the New Yorker, and they still publish his work, and every time I see a Sam Gross cartoon, I see what he's holding back. I know what he would do if he did the same subject for the National Lampoon. She says, well then, for God's sakes, what have you done with your tea bag? It's a tea bag cartoon. Sean Kelly, and we see Sean here with, I'm gonna read something that Sean wrote, an introduction. To this is Sean, and above Sean is, below Sean is a picture from Son of God comics, where little Benny David, a little Jewish boy living in Brooklyn, something happens to him. He says, Jesus Christ, and he turns into Son of God. And here he is walking across the water, and in the background is what everybody's saying to him. The Sean was the poet laureate of the National Lampoon. We are lucky to have Chris Kelly here tonight. His son. He did Babar, and Babar and his enemies. And in Babar and Barbar and his enemies, the monkeys rise up and they kill Babar and Celeste and hang them from meat hooks. And at the end, it says there's Zephyr who kills them, Zephyr the monkey, and it says, long live President Zephyr. And I asked Sean to write an introduction to this story as it appears in this book. And he wrote, Jean de Brunhoff's 1931 Histoire de Babar is an anti-imperialist satire, a beast fable in the tradition of medieval fabliau. Anatole France, L'Île des Pingouins, 1908, Animal Farm, and Mouse. Consider the illustration of the colorful pastoral jungle when it is transformed by civilization into the drab, prison-like Celesteville. But the many Babar books that followed became little more than marketing devices for plush toys, meriting the accusation by Ariel Dorfman in The Empire's Old Clothes, 1996, that they anticipate the theory of neocolonialism, hence the inevitable uprising. Venceremos. And this is what Sean wrote as an introduction to this story. This is what he was thinking when he was writing this parody of a children's book. And of course, this ad of his, 132,000 peace Roman Catholics set, which Sean Kelly created this. And this is the kind of thing they did. They didn't just write stories. They wrote comics. They wrote ads. They wrote all kinds of different things, and they had people execute them. It says, if you can't read the small type, fight again the Albigensian Crusade, Catholic against Christian. The Albigensian Crusade? Mount your own brave defense of Béziers, where on July 22nd, 1209, 20,000 men, women, and children, innocent Cathar heretics, the first Protestants, were raped, slaughtered, and burned. Here's what you get, 12 bishops. And it goes on to say, gentlemen, rush me my set. So, and it's possible that only Sean Kelly would have had the know-how to even know what the Albigensian Crusade was and about the rape and killing of everybody in Béziers. Charlie Rodriguez, a little muffin of a guy, Rodriguez with an S, he always said, and was a great Lampoon cartoonist for many years. Here's a cartoon that takes place in the Soviet Union. Can you read it? I tell you, Boris, the Soviet Union has got to be the worst goddamn place in the world to be a transvestite. The way those guys are dressed is perfect. And here's one. Son of a bitch, we four Jews start off on a plot to control the world, and we end up with four different plots. An Orthodox plot, a conservative plot, a reform plot, and a Lubavitcher plot. And this is from a church-going Catholic who lived on the coast of Massachusetts, but he knew exactly what he was talking about. And he'd come down and met enough of us here at the Lampoon in New York. This strikes me as very funny. And this also strikes me as funny. This is, I just love the guys hiding in the booth. Brian McConaughey was editor at the National Lampoon for 4 years. Below him is just a little piece of something he did, a comic thing he did. And the word thup makes me happier than any other word in this whole book. P.J. O'Rourke, pointing to a map of Antarctica. Douglas Kenny and P.J. O'Rourke did the National Lampoon's great 1964 high school yearbook parody, and this is the cover. And applause, really? And this was published in 1973, but they went back to Dacron, Ohio, in 1964, and they made this book. And recently, it's been republished by someone, and because they're worried about getting it into places like Costco, there is a yellow band crossing that girl's behind, right where it's exposed, so that you can't see it, thereby taking away the whole joke of the cover. And it's that kind of lack of chutzpah that would make the whole thing a mediocre enterprise, I think. And here's a, this is one of the interior pages. On the lower right, Maria Theresa's spermatozoa. Gayon Wilson, a great cartoonist for Playboy for over 50 years, worked for the National Lampoon for 17, and doing articles for them. And Gayon has said to me, this is a self-portrait, by the way. It's Gayon at 100. And look at the little hands on the lower left. Gayon has said to me that even though he worked at Playboy all those years, no one ever gave him the freedom to do his work that he had at the National Lampoon, where they'd call him up and they'd say, Gahan, the theme this issue is betrayal or fraud, and we need 5 pages. And goodbye, and send it in when you're done. And that kind of freedom was liberating for an artist. Here's something from Child's Secret Fears that Gahan did. It's emblematic of the kind of work he would do for the magazine. Here's something else. Gahan is a, let's say, can somebody be a bit of an atheist? Well, Gahan is. And this is all about how money drives everything in religion. It did not please Charlie Rodriguez, a church-going Catholic that I told you about, who, when he and Gahan met at a cartoonist's convention, they have these things, instead of shaking his hand, turned around on his heel and stormed away. This is a man who would stay up all night drawing the most horrible things, and because probably Charlie thought God couldn't see him at night. But he didn't like what Gahan did. Jerry Sussman, dear Jerry Sussman, posing with I don't know what there. Maybe it's a harp seal. Jerry, in one issue, did a 12-page parody of the Yellow Pages. And it was an amazing thing that he wrote every part of the Yellow Pages. And you can see on the right, Henry Kissinger's School of Kissing. There's a Spitzer, the chest hair people. And over here on the left, accountants, Jewish. And there are 250 names in that. And there are names like Milton Radish and Murray Rabbi and Albert Sweatgarb and Nathan Brill Building. Jerry could not stop. He filled an entire, he thought it would only be funny if he could do an entire page. Yeah. Bruce McCall worked for the Lampoon for a number of years. You may know him as the New Yorker artist. He did this great piece. This is DeSoto discovering the Mississippi. And Kay Brown. There were women at the Lampoon. There were women writers and there were women cartoonists. And the best of the women cartoonists was the great M.K. Brown, who lives in the Bay Area. She worked, I think, probably 17 or 18 years for the Lampoon and did terrific things. This cartoon says, heck no, we're not crazy. Why? Do we look crazy? You be the judge. Here's a strip, The White Girl Twist. Look, no words. The Lampoon was given to great visuals like this. What is not to like about that? The artist brought it into the magazine and said, the artist named Wayne McLaughlin said, I don't know what to do with this, but I've painted this and I think it's funny. And so the Lampoon came up with the headline. This cover appeared on the Lampoon before the 76 Olympics. It was a steroid thing. And this, something about matrimony and heterosexuality. This is by the great Lampoon artist Mara McAfee. I think that's Emily Prager. What do you think, Ted? That looks like her posing for that picture there. This is the Doctors and Lawyers issue, and you see them there under the lamppost with the... This one makes me smile. And of course, the 3D issue. That's Stevie Wonder. It seems very au courant, don't you think, 3D? But this was 1975. And that, and then the vengeance issue during the Iran hostage crisis. It seems cathartic. And this. Ted, this, it says, it's the banana issue. What, I can't hear you, right? I've got a banana in my... Ted Mann, who's sitting over there as the creator of Brave Dog magazine. And Ted wrote a little introduction for Brave Dog as it appears in this book. He said, "I have always liked Brave Dog without being able to explain why. Perhaps I just like dogs. Their plight is ours, writ small. For all their devotion and pissing on the carpets, the purpose for their existence remains a mystery to them. Though in order that this not trouble them excessively, Providence has granted them the ability to lick their own genitals. Yet we recognize our situation in theirs and find that predicament troubling, or why would we say die like a dog? They die just as we do, you see. Had I their special ability, these questions would not arise." And here's a Lampoon ad written by Ted some years ago. This was a subscription ad. And it showed that at the Lampoon, they would even take the time to work on the subscription ads and make them funny. And here it says, "All I can think of is dogs licking my heart." It says, "National Lampoon editor Ted Mann has writer's block caused by the publisher's rejection of his earlier funnier sub-ad. And now some clown has copped his job." I do love that. Ted Mann lives in the bushes behind the 7-Eleven now. Ted Mann was famously the most uninhibited and unpredictable of all the people who ever worked at the National Lampoon, or so they say. He was the most real of all the people that ever worked there, I say. He is a great writer of tough, smart prose and has always had serious issues on his mind. But before he could get to them, he was one of the writers of Disco Beaver from Outer Space. And he and Todd Carroll created O.C. and Stiggs. Ted has written and produced for Miami Vice, NYPD Blue, Judging Amy, John from Cincinnati, Deadwood, and too many other shows and movies for me to list here. Although he might like it if I did. The way I see it, he has irons in every fire in this town. And I would like Ted to either come up or say a few words from his chair right now.
Yes. Thank you, Rick. And it's good to see you guys again. I wrote this, actually I don't write anymore, I just dictate, and somebody transcribes it, and they weren't available when I was sitting in the Starbucks, so I had to write it myself on this little black notebook. And I guess this is true, I'm going to try and say true things. That I do believe that if you have very little to say, you should not hesitate to say it. And this being the case, I'm going to ask myself a question. And it's one I've been asked many times. It's a common question, so I hope it'll be satisfactory in some way. And the question is, what was it like to work at National Lampoon? And you never really get to answer it unless you control the microphone like I do right now, because if you try to, the people's eyes roll back in their heads and they run the other way. Perhaps because of the political situation in 1974, when I started there, I had the sensation, and I know some others had it too, that it was possible only to impersonate a whole life. It was not actually possible to be or to live a whole life. And I know it's not an uncommon feeling, and it was an existence that was not without its raptures as well. It would take me until the day before yesterday to recognize that that way of being was every bit as authentic, a loathsome word, and as legitimate another as any other way of being. In support of which, I'll cite the story of somebody's grandpa at a at a state fair where they were offering rides for $5. And Grandpa went up in the plane and flew around for 15 minutes, and he came back down, and one of his loved ones asked him, what was it like, you know, to ride around? He said, it was interesting. He said, but I never did put my full weight down. I don't trust those things. And accompanying the sensation of partially inhabiting your own life, there was a benign corollary that it permitted impatience with the superfluities and the pomposities of other people's lives and wherever else they might be lodged in the culture. An example of this, and it springs to mind, of somebody fatuous, I would characterize them as, going on about the symbolism of Belle Isle in the poetry of Hart Crane. And Timothy Mayer interrupted him after it had gone on for a bit too long, probably 45 seconds. And he said, Belle Isle is an island off Labrador, for fuck's sake. And periodically, not predictably, somebody would disappear into an office and close the door, and one of those old Selectrics would rattle away for some hours. And they'd come out with something astounding. And however often that happened, there was never enough, or the feeling there was never enough, to fill the magazine. And that required the remaining pages to be filled with second-rate material, resulting in a sense of shame that was the other wing, or the unbenign corollary, that easily attached to a persona that felt itself less than the full inhabitant of a life. And that's what it was like to work at the National Lampoon. Thank you. You don't have to like it, Rick. You just have to clap, because you're a polite guy.
Everything you need to know about to be a really Jewish Jew. And this may come to the market among Jews. And you can read Ellis's work on the Huffington Post. And Ellis is going to read something to you now.
Thank you, Rick. I did live in fear of not understanding, especially the Catholics, Sean and Tony and Ted, I assume. But no? But.
Begensian.
Oh, well. Who isn't? But I, you know, so I just sort of kept my hands to myself and got through it. Now, when I arrived, it was with a friend of mine named Danny Abelson, who I had met while we were both working at Strand Bookstore, which is still there. Danny and I had both been at Penn the same 4 years, but we didn't know each other then. And one thing led to another, and we were both interested in art, and I was pitching, speaking of Brian McConaughey, Brian was my first editor there, and he was a very funny writer, but a completely incomprehensible editor. Oh yeah, this is in the book. This was from, so Danny and I did an art news parody, and this is a racquetball court.
Yeah, it says Collection Fifth Avenue Racquet Club.
And editors would take turns editing specific issues, so Danny and I decided we wanted to do the grow-up issue. The sincerity with which we edited the grown-up issue reminds me of what Ted just said about living not quite a fully baked life, but it's the only life you have. So what I'd like to do is read Danny's editorial and then sing, with your assistance, my reply. Danny wrote, a friendly warning, and if I could do it in his South African accent, I would, but I can't. A word to the wise, there's nowhere to grow but up. Consider the available alternatives, such as the ageless hippie route. You may not believe it now, but those who've been there will tell you that coming off a two-day acid trip on the food stamp line at your local welfare office just doesn't do it after a while. Nor does sleeping on the floor. Not only do people and animals and those in between literally step on your face at regular intervals, but sooner or later you wake up one gray morning with your tongue lying on the carpet like a piece of liver and your hair clotted with hash brownie, and you realize that today is the day your little sister graduates from law school. Then, of course, you might try to hold on to that carefree, hang-loose attitude you prize so highly by developing what the magazines call an aggressively youthful lifestyle. One small hitch, history teaches us that those who treat life in the real world like an endless extension of freshman year at college almost invariably end up lurching forward suddenly some evening while removing their sneakers in a musty locker room. Do you think it's fun winding up your days stone dead at 31 with a sock clutched in your right hand, a grimace of pain and surprise on your now frozen features, and a chorus of friends remarking sadly on the irony of your being the one to go? He played ice hockey and polo every day and practiced for intramural decathlon on his lunch hour. It just doesn't make any sense. I only bring up these unpleasant scenarios to your attention to save you and your loved ones needless heartache and grief later on. To be frank, these are comparatively benign forms of evasion. Incest, Satanism, and the uglier varieties of psychotic disorder are just a few of the strategies I have declined to elaborate on. But enough doom and gloom. My point is made, and I can hope to do no more. You can either decide, now that you are armed with the facts, to grow up and take your rightful place as a soldier in the ranks of society's army, or you can sit around reading comics and scratching yourself and waiting for the enforcement squads to burst through your door and drag you into the street and beat you to within an inch of your putrid little self-absorbed life. The choice is yours. And that was, thank you, on his behalf, that was Danny's editorial. Now mine, entitled A Responsible Reply, was to rewrite the words of the song I Won't Grow Up from Peter Pan. So if you know the show, you know that I'll be Peter and you all will be Michael, John, and Wendy, and you'll just repeat every line that I sing. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
And I won't be an adult.
I won't be an adult.
With a lawyer and accountant.
and
a broker to consult.
A broker to consult.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
And I won't wear a toupee.
I won't wear a toupee.
Or feel guilty about my diet.
Or feel guilty about my diet.
And some stupid creme brulee.
Creme brulee.
If growing up means I must wear a jock strap swimming to protect down there, I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up. Don't care. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't like Time Magazine.
I don't like Time Magazine.
And I think that Jimmy Reston should be conked
upon the bean.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
Cause the opera makes me puke.
The opera makes me puke.
And I won't use Aquavelva.
Like
some cretin from Dubuque.
If
growing up means I must read New Yorker articles on Margaret Mead, I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up. Indeed. Now comes the bridge. Never gonna play a game of golf. Never gonna see a shrink or Ibsen. Anybody says to drink a Gibson onion in the glass. Shove it up his ass. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't wanna learn to screw.
I don't wanna learn to screw.
Cause the women all are scary.
Scary.
And there's too much stuff to do. If
growing
up means I must choose between a pair of Keds and Gucci shoes, I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up. Fuck yous. Fuck you. Fuck yous. So there. Thank you. You were great.
Chris Kelly, well, that's Sean Kelly. Chris Kelly is sitting in the chair here. He is the son of Sean Kelly. Many of you in the audience grew up with the National Lampoon. Chris grew up at the National Lampoon. The Lampoon office was where he went for daycare. He spent more time there than most of the people who actually worked at the place. And I can tell you, not having been addled with various brain-addling substances, he recalls better than the rest of us what actually went on up there. Chris has written for Bill Maher's show for years now, and I've got a big dash here, Chris, because I don't know how many years.
On and off, 16.
16 years, yeah. For Bill Maher. He is sharper than sharp. Just ask those on the receiving end of his regular HuffPost blog. Chris's Huffington Post blog begins with the words, "Chris Kelly is not the Chris Kelly who plays for the Ottawa Senators, but wouldn't it be cool if he were?" And I say, nah, here's the cooler Chris Kelly. Chris?
Hi. Yeah, I'm a ringer up here. My father is alive and well and in Brooklyn teaching English to art students at Pratt, because someone has to do it. And so it's tonight, the part of Judy Garland will be played by Lorna Luft. I was around at the Lampoon as a kid, and I have the Lampoon disappeared, and it came back briefly. It kept coming out. It was like, there's that line in Dawn of the Dead, which is, "Don't be confused and think this is one of your relatives." It exists only to kill. It still had a name, and it still looked like the magazine. And some people tried to bring it back in the early 80s, and I guess because I'd been around as a kid, I was one of the people. And I have a story about that, and you can decide if it's funny or sad. Well, they decided to clean it up and put it out again and bring in interesting new people and redesign it and try to figure out a way. At the time, it was on the newsstand, it was racked between Barely Legal and Black Tail, which didn't make sense alphabetically or anything else.
At best.
So the only people who were, all the great people were had moved on, of course, and the subscribers were in jail. Because the complexity of the law was you couldn't get real hardcore porn in jail. You could only get the Lampoon. And so they cleaned up the magazine thinking that they could get people to sample it again and look at it again and try to bring back the glory days. And no one did, but they got a pile of angry subscription cancellations from jail. And then the magazine, went away for good, and I like to think that it wasn't the internet that killed print; it was me. But my one of the things that my dad, one of his specialties at the magazine was poetry parodying James Joyce or Thomas Hardy or Kipling or. Because that's a real money maker, and you can all see the target. And this is just a poem he wrote for the high school yearbook parody, for the literary magazine. And this is a poem by the Kefauver High's Young Republican Club president Chuck Farley, who you'll figure it out anyhow. But he's a moron, but he's a high school moron. And I think anyhow the poem, it's 1964. The poem's called "The Dead Martyr." Down the street the big car drives, our handsome president still lives. Strong and vigorous is his life, and so is the life of his well-dressed wife. Cheers are loud in the Texas sun, standing proud in the Texas sun. The people all cheer, Americans all, not knowing he too soon will fall. And no one in the crowd giving a shout hears the fatal shot ring out. A president dead in the Texas sun, shot in the head in the Texas sun. A nation mourns the loss of life in sympathy with the glamorous wife. His children salute their father's grave. He died all of our lives to save. A solemn tune in the Texas sun, taken too soon in the Texas sun. We ask for the mad assassin's name, and yet in a way we are all to blame. It is for us determined to be, to keep our country strong and free. The eagle flies in the Texas sun, under starry skies in the Texas sun.
That's awesome.
I wrote something in Rick's book about another of the editors, whose name is Brian McConaughey. And I said that when I was 10 and I used to be underfoot at the Lampoon, Brian would slip out every night and go to see a Tom Stoppard play called Jumpers and on Broadway. And the thing about Jumpers was, for about a half a second, Diana Rigg is naked in it. And Brian would go every night and sit in the front row with opera glasses and watch Diana Rigg naked every night. And I got I haven't spoken to Brian in 15 years anyway, and I got an email from him after the book came out. And the gist of it was this. Diana Rigg wasn't naked in Jumpers. She was naked in Abelard and Eloise. And they weren't opera glasses, they were field glasses. And if you have the book, you can turn to page 176 and make that correction for yourself. You'll thank me later.
So, thank you, Chris. So, yeah, as I said earlier, that kind of thing can wear you out. What happened to the Lampoon, 1975, with the arrival of Saturday Night Live, staffed with Lampoon writers and actors, the magazine began to lose its grip on its audience. Animal House, which appeared in 1978, was probably the Lampoon's last significant contribution to the culture. And so bright and talented editors and contributors kept the magazine afloat for another few years, but they met with diminishing results because you can't sustain that kind of energy. Until finally, in 1990, the whole lackluster enterprise capsized, which is probably the funniest thing they'd done in years, and unnoticed sank out of sight. People still say, is the Lampoon still publishing? And it hasn't published an issue for 20 years. The magazine's writers and artists had by then dispersed to the ends of the comedy earth, which means mainly they came here to Los Angeles. The end of the earth. They work in movies and television. They publish numerous books and written plays and movies, and many have had great success. Yet aside from the founders, their names are not well known. Well, you know a few of them tonight. And I read a piece recently by Michael Palin reminiscing about his days with Monty Python. He said, and I'm quoting, "I was the Spanish Inquisition. I was one half of the fish slapping dance. I did the lumberjack song. I look at my life and I think that may be the most important thing I've ever done." I recognize the feeling. Those of us fortunate enough to still be breathing will tell you the work we did for the National Lampoon will probably be the most important contribution to whatever culture will have them. We were lucky enough to have been part of such a funny and exhilarating enterprise, as silly as it was sometime, and it was could be amazingly silly, and as serious a business as it could be, it was for many of us the best work we've ever done. So we're gonna sit down now and take some questions from you folks, and maybe we should turn up the lights. Questions?
There's someone in the front.
Someone in the front. You'll have to ask a long question. I don't see any other hands raised.
Stall.
I'll do the best I can. When I was an impressionable junior high school student at band camp, I snuck off and bought this. I don't know if you recognize it, but it's the Dacron
Oh, it's the Sunday newspaper.
Sunday newspaper parody. I haven't picked it up in 35 years, but it's still intact, and I still have it. And
you brought it with you.
And I brought it with me. So I want to return it for a refund.
Last week, okay, but it's...
But seriously,
they're going to check and see if it has a library card in it.
Well,
so you owe some fines.
Considering what I'm paying for parking tonight, I feel entitled to it. But my question is, how do you think the Lampoon would have dealt with issues such as the Muhammad cartoon crisis that's going on right now?
Oh, that's a good question.
And I'll thank you not to ask it.
I know just how I would have dealt with it as the cartoonist and caricaturist here, the way I dealt with the Ayatollah, which you saw earlier. When that crisis came out, I filled my sketchbook with drawings of Muhammad. And I did a sort of a deco Muhammads. I did cubist Muhammads. I did, goofy cartoon Muhammads. And nobody came to get me. And I think that there would have been a bunch of us proposing this piece at the Lampoon if there still was a Lampoon. We just wouldn't have been able to wait to get on it. And the publisher would have said, wait, 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 wait. He would have been the one saying, wait.
Yeah,
right?
I agree. Yeah, we would all have wanted to do it. And the publisher would say, not on your life.
Yeah, and not on his life.
Not on his, well, not on your life.
Yeah.
I don't know how it would have been resolved. It's a good question.
Yeah, who knows what would have, if it would have gotten published.
Well, you published the cartoons about Muhammad that you rejected to show people what kind of
the bad ones.
God,
it couldn't be straightforward.
Ecumenical person you are.
That's right. It would have to be mixed in with cartoons of other great sages. Moses.
Racists and cultural imperialists send us these things all the time, and we don't publish them, and we want to show you that.
Yeah. Okay,
here's proof.
That's exactly right.
Blame them.
See, no more questions.
No more questions.
So I have to pee, too.
Yes.
Thanks. Thanks for all your stories. Brings back a lot of memories of reading the magazine as a very impressionable young girl. Chris, I'll talk to you later. We can have some growing up at the Lampoon stories. But in the spirit of nothing is sacred, you talked about Brilliant, not so much Drunken Stone, but didn't really talk at all about Dead. And I remember how, like, Von Bode and just the reaction within the magazine of a lot of unfortunate and stupid deaths of a lot of the creative people there.
Those autoerotic asphyxiation deaths are always sad, but they also make you laugh. They also make you laugh.
It's not an unalloyed
sad. Never forget this.
There were a lot of deaths, and it is sad. And one of the things that, when I decided to do this book, one of the things I wanted to do is create the record for some of the people that have been forgotten. And it's possible Doug Kenny, who died in 1980 at the age of 33, won't be forgotten because there are biographies of him. And he's the one that people generally talk about when they think of the Lampoon as one of the founders.
That's what Michael said. And everybody asked, do you think he committed suicide? And Michael O'Donohue said, he slipped while he was looking for a place to jump.
Right. And someone else said that at his funeral, someone said that Doug was such an indecisive guy that as he was falling, he probably looked up and saw a better place to have jumped from. There were other people, George Trow, who died in Naples in, I think, 2006. There was...
Michael himself?
Michael O'Donohue, who died in 1996 of a brain hemorrhage.
He sat up and he said, that's it.
That's it.
To show. So he died happy.
He died happy.
George's mysterious circumstances.
George, mysterious circumstances. He was found in an apartment in Naples. Jerry Sussman died of an asthma attack. Charlie Rodriguez dropped dead one day while taking a walk.
Most of these guys died funny. I mean, Jerry died
from a cat.
Of cats.
Yeah.
You know, he went to sleep and he got an allergy attack and he wasn't able to wake up, so he had to die.
And somebody like that would be forgotten now. And
I thought that talents like that.
We should die half as funny.
We should die half as funny as Jerry. Jerry had the funniest memorial service. Doug's was a little not so funny. Jerry's was hilarious. I think people were screaming from laughter at the church, and which was even funny because he was a Jew and he was had his memorial service in St. Luke's Church in Greenwich Village. Jerry would have appreciated the irony.
I don't know. I mean, if you're at Doug's and you saw Peter Ivers playing the harmonica over the grave, I mean, it was moving, but too. It was also incredibly funny.
Yeah, they say in the dark way.
I mean, he wasn't
which
Sonny
you
Boy
would
Lance.
See more than I.
That's true. That's true. You're like a nice, warm Myron Cohen yeah. type, heartwarming story.
Myron Cohen. Does anyone know Myron Cohen? He tells endless stories.
Very sweet stories, too. Very yeah. heartwarming. But they have a dark underbelly to them, most of them.
You can Google him. You can YouTube Myron Cohen and see like an hour of Myron Cohen on YouTube.
But you don't have to.
I won't be here tomorrow. It's not a homework assignment. But Myron Cohen wasn't in the Lampoon.
I'll say.
He wasn't.
Right. Well, he was, except that Jerry Sussman was. So. Yeah.
Jerry Sussman was.
Yeah. Yeah. Sussman's, he had the reputation of being the unstoppable professional. When everyone else was too drunk or tired or stoned, he would always come through. And he had this thing, I don't know whether it really happened to him or he had heard about it at a staff comedy a TV show meeting, but apparently all the writers were exhausted. It was 2 a.m. and nobody could think of anything. And somebody had on a wristwatch, as we did in those days, and he held it up and he'd say, "Is there anything in this?" And that just meant a comedy desperation. And sometimes there was something in this. Now we hold up cell phones and, you know, there's everything in that.
That's right. So Sussman, I used to meet Jerry Sussman in Chinatown to discuss the next article we were going to do together. And we always began it in Chinatown. And we'd choose a restaurant. Sometimes we'd have a discussion about it. And we'd go in and Jerry would ask the waiter for dishes that didn't exist. Do you have bird drop soup? Drop soup. He said, what was it? Twice chewed pork. But the waiter, you know, the waiter chews it and then they deep fry it at the table. And the second time it's chewed, you're chewing it. And my favorite, of course, was Chef, he had written about Chef Lou several times. And it was Chef Lou's golden shower pork ribs. Marinated in the chef's own natural juices.
Rick, Jerry meeting Mel Brooks. You and Jerry walking down the street and seeing Mel Brooks.
I should say that. I should have said that there'd be some four-letter words here tonight. I was walking down the street with Jerry, who was working at the Lampoon and working at J. Walter Thompson advertising. And he did that. He sort of did both jobs at the same time. One doesn't know how he was able to be in both offices at the same time. He does have a brother named Harvey who looks just like him. But Harvey's in Texas, so I think that wasn't it. And we're walking down Jane Street together in Greenwich Village. And I say to Jerry, "Hey, Jerry, look." And it's Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks is getting out of a car. I say, "Jerry, look, Mel Brooks." And Jerry turns and says, "Fuck you, Mel." Yells it out like that. All those years of resentment of working two jobs, you know, and there's this other Jew who's making $1 million in movies, you know, and is famous, and Jerry just poured out of him and exploded out of him. Fuck you, Mel.
Jerry is this big. I mean, he was not a large man.
There was no time, there was no beat in between my saying it and Jerry saying it. His brain shot it out.
You know, I want to tell the story about his dad because, Sean was out here, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, and he was passing by the Writers Guild, an organization. He didn't fill him with, respect. And there was there were lilies growing outside. And he says, look, they're lilying the guild. Now, fortunately, he didn't repeat things like that. He only said them once.
One time, Ted, my little sister Siobhan, was 6 or 7, and Ted decided to take her to the Russian tea room.
She had the vodka there.
And they were standing in line at the Russian tea room, and Ted said to this little girl, she said, why are we going to the Russian tea room? And she said, there are famous people there. And she said, like who? And he said, that lady up there, that's Sandy Duncan. Go up there and stare at her and see if her eye moves. And so we were from a tiny town in Quebec town, 2000. And so Sandy Duncan was, you know, and my sister ran up and stared at her for a little while and stared at her and then ran back and said, nah, both eyes moved, you're lying.
I wrote about this in the book, but I'll tell you because Ted is here and I want him to hear me tell the story. The Lampoon offices were at Madison between 59th and 60th, and across either Madison or 59th was another high-rise office building. And in the window on the same floor as we were, on the fourth floor of the opposite building, it must have been an advertising agency, but in the window were 4 boxes of Tide detergent from large to baby, and it was like a family of Tide. A big daddy box and a slightly smaller mommy box and then 2 little boxes. And, you know, I'd seen this on and off. You just get used to it. So I went into Ted's office once, and I'm talking to him. I don't remember why. And I look, and on his shelf at his window, he had put 4 boxes of Tide detergent. And I thought, it's so touching. He's trying to communicate. And I thought that was one of the smartest things I'd ever seen. So
trying to make him think he'd lost the account, kill himself.
That's right.
You know, I forget what issue it was, but we had all these butterflies, you know, that were preserved butterflies. They were real, that the art director had gotten from somewhere. And after the photo shoot, there were, you know, a number of bags of butterflies left. And you sprinkled them out the window onto Madison Avenue during the lunchtime crowd. And there was just thousands of the most beautiful butterflies in the world falling down. And the New Yorkers stomping them into the sidewalk like that. Maybe 1 or 2 out-of-towners would look around and go, wow, butterflies are beautiful.
And no one had time for them.
That's right.
$7,000 worth of butterflies.
Wasn't that funny? Slaughtered.
Wasn't even a good cover, I remember it.
Really?
It was a lame cover. But it was
garbage truck and butterflies.
The Madison Avenue stuff would have been a New Yorker thing because it wasn't quite funny, but it had a sort of a point to make, you know, about the metaphysics of people walking down the street. It wouldn't make you laugh because we don't want that. But it would make you sort of think for a while, and then you'd think, oh, God, I'm really stupid. And that's what the New Yorker was very, very good at. Except for George, you know, who had this astonishing gift of being both truthful and mystifying. And saying things with such authority that they went unquestioned. And at the New Yorker, everything was kind of questioned by ranks of editors whose job it was to say, how do you substantiate that particular assertion? And they would never do it to George because his manner was such, his demeanor was such, it didn't bear questioning. You would ask Dwight David Eisenhower right before the invasion of Normandy just what the fuck he thought he was doing before you would ask George why he called his book The Context of No Context. I'll just keep talking.
This is in the context of No Context was filled an entire issue of The New Yorker in 1980, I think, or 81, and became a really famous book that many people didn't read. It was published as a book and people bought it, and it's, you know,
the what they call the takeaway on television was television is shit. And but George said it in a way that was very beautiful and actually probably true. And those of us who wanted to know why, you know, would cite it. I mean,
right. It was a really
incredible
indictment of American media and values, and a really interesting book.
And the kind of damage it does to us to be exposed to it all the time. And we were often accused of doing damage to people, and I just don't think that was the case. I think many times, we were less apt than we would have wanted to be. But I think essentially the Stowe points was a concept that Henry had that measured the cultural change that was affected by a published work. Stowe was Harriet Beecher Stowe. The book was Uncle Tom's Cabin. And you would look at Michael's Vietnamese baby book and say, how many Stowe points on that, you know? And it actually had a couple of them, you know? And there were a number of things like that, however, you know, they might have hurt you to look at them a first time. If they prompted you to think and to understand that there was, there's always people who are going to hear a word like nigger and think you're a racist, and they're morons. And we have to hold the line against morons, because if we don't, you know, they're going to make us their slaves. And I don't want that for any of you, and I don't want it for my friends, so.
Well, speaking of that, the Son of God comic that Sean did was the most controversial, brought the most
Son
negative
God, yeah.
response.
Caused myocardial infarctions
all over
the Vatican.
Didn't they publish an apology or something?
They published three separate Son of God comics. They published it. They did sequels.
That's in case somebody thought the first two times were an accident.
Yeah. Gee, I thought they got the wrist slapped, and Maddie said, no, we've got to apologize. No?
They did it anyway.
Well, I mean, there's a considerable amount of advertising that departed, but it always was. When the Jiminy Cricket Nixon cover ran, the Uncola became the Unsponsor, as Sean Kelly famously said about the radio show. And, you know, it wasn't the church that objected to these things, by the way. It was layman's groups who had official seals and wrote to Japanese car companies who didn't know that official seal did not represent the Pope. Mm-hmm. They thought it might.
And Chris, didn't you, you've been writing on the Huffington Post about this Catholic group.
Oh, the Catholic Families for America?
Yeah.
Which are two guys. And
Catholic guys. They're Catholic.
They're Catholic, but they've endorsed a slate
they're
of
married.
Candidates.
No, they are married.
They've endorsed a slate of candidates in the next election, but one of the candidates they endorsed was Christine O'Donnell, who we're obsessed with at the show these days. But they're an organization of so little significance, she wrote their name wrong. She calls them the Catholic Families of America. And so you get into this war with the commenters about, I said they didn't exist, they said they did because they had a website. I said that hardly exists. So I've started my own Facebook page, which is the Catholic Families of America. And if you go to us, we're very angry about being confused with the other group.
angry but forgiving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, the question, I mean, I never understood about, you know, why it was worth working with comics. There's something about stand-up comics, which is whenever you tell them to stop, they have to go again. You know, it's such a weird thing socially. Okay, you've really hurt my feelings, now you have to stop.
They always make me kind of cringe because they seem to be so uncomfortable up there. And like sitcoms.
Not like us.
Not like us. Somebody would say, Rick, you said to me the other day, haven't you seen, you know, do a sitcom about a crazy magazine and all the strange people that
right.
work there? And I remember
cringe.
People bringing it up at the time, and everybody sort of going, oh, God. And trying to think of, you know, and there have maybe been some, you know, sitcoms that didn't make me think of Neil Simon as the apotheosis of the form, you know? So there he is, you know, rising right just above the mediocre. And If you, I mean, it's okay. You end up there all the time. It's very possible. It's the, it wouldn't be mediocre if that's where you didn't land most of the time. But you aim higher than that, you know. You don't aim at a sitcom. Maybe you aim for a drama or changing the world or saving humanity, and then you end up with a sitcom.
And a laugh track. Right? A sitcom and a laugh track.
Yeah, they all have laugh
tracks. To tell
tracks.
You when to
they
laugh.
Will not let you do one without a laugh track.
Wait, you know that? You have to have a laugh track?
Really? I saw 2 minutes.
Say, unless you can make me laugh. So is that, you know, a quorum of egg-sitting network executives, and they don't laugh.
Gentlemen, how about a question from the audience? Question?
Of course.
This is very scary.
Do you cover anything about the National Lampoon Radio Hour in your book, or do you have any stories about that?
I wish you did.
I don't. It was a big subject. I ran out of pages.
I'll tell you one story about it, though. When I was sitting up there, and it was back in 74, when just before it died, and I had spent a large portion of my draw on a gram of cocaine. I had it in my pocket, and John Belushi came in. He says, "Do you have any blow?" I said, "Of course I do, Mr. Belushi." And I took it out. He looked at it. He opened it up. He went, "Thanks." He gave me back the little piece of tinfoil. Took it all, one nostril.
So that's what was going on up there.
That's why he.
Back then, we didn't know it was addictive. That's true. That's true. This is what, 74? I got there at 76.
Yeah, it was the OxyContin of its day. It was marketed as non-addictive.
Ted and I were in the Amazon in April of this year for Vanity Fair. And the article that Ted is writing is about recreational drug taking down in the Amazon. And
spiritual tourism. Well, I mean, it's spiritual not recreational. Tourism. Nothing and that makes you vomit for 20 minutes can be recreational.
Ayahuasca, the drug in question, acts as a paralytic on the nervous system of the digestive tract, and it makes everyone who takes it throw up at least 3 times. It's a very attractive situation. Ted and I were at an ayahuasca event and watched people barf.
Ceremony is called, yeah.
We said, did you get high? How would you feel? What were your hallucinations like? And I remember, what did Gemma say, that woman? Said, I saw pretty colors. That's it. You threw up in a bucket 3 times, and that's it. If I threw up in a bucket 3 times, I'd probably see pretty colors, too.
And but it wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't
what
be.
We did was we would not go near that stuff. We're very sober individuals, but it turns out everybody down there is chewing coca leaves, which is the undistilled and fabricated portion of cocaine. And
the benign form.
The benign form. And so every day we'd be chewing our coca leaves, and there's a little thing of green drool coming down our chins. And I found it was a little bit like caffeine, only without the coffee, which was okay. We just got into the native thing, you know?
You went native.
On the way out of there, we stopped at the airport, and at the cemetery, which was quite beautiful on the way, and mm-hmm. Little kids, you want to see Hitler's grave? And it costs a couple soles, but you get to go and see Hitler's grave, and it's unmarked. But the local people know it's there, so they write requests, prayers, if you will. They put them on a piece of paper, and you stick it in Hitler's grave, and I guess maybe he has more influence or power on the other side than he had here. Maybe his plan succeeded on the other side. And anyway, there's thousands and thousands of notes stuck
if
there.
If you ever get to Iquitos in Peru, you can go to the cemetery and see that somebody will take you over there to see it. You won't get to Iquitos by road. It's the largest city in the world, not accessible by road. You can only get in by river or fly in.
Yeah. Rick says it's craptastic, but
yeah, it's the crappiest place I've ever been to.
Well, and you can still get downtown without driving for 3 hours, you know, from 7 miles away, like Los Angeles.
We're going to go to another crappy place, though. I'm sure that there's another one just as crappy.
We want to specialize in junkets for magazines to the most sordid and depraved and sad cities in the world and find something to laugh at there.
Yeah. And, by the way, steamy. Steamy city.
Yeah, there was one, I remember once at the Lampoon, and I only heard it vaguely because I didn't know what you were doing. You and Todd Carroll bought a cheap plastic egg for about $5. At some place on 14th Street. And Ted and his partner bought this.
No, it was just me. He wasn't involved in any egg.
Bought this crappy plastic egg and sent it or photographed it and sent it to Malcolm Forbes and said, do you think there's something to this?
No,
that's great.
I asked him how to get these things open. Fabergé egg was his collection.
But then you went on a trip for Forbes to the...
He sent me to Bulgaria. Yeah.
To the House
of Humor and Satire. Yeah.
You went in Gabrovo, Bulgaria, the House of Humor.
I always say that because Steve Forbes said of his father, all the Forbes men, something strange happens to them when they're 40. I ran for president. My father took to young boys. And I always want to make it clear that I wasn't one of the young boys. I was the guy that sent the egg.
That's right. You went to the House of Humor and Satire. There was a convention. So I got an invitation.
I met the dictator. I met the dictator.
Of Bulgaria.
Yeah. You know they're sending all the Jewish foreskins back to Russia, and they're planting them in the potato fields? To grow little dictators.
On that note, gentlemen.
Is that a note?
I want to thank you all for an absolutely brilliant, drunk, stoned, deadly evening.
Thank you, Justin.
If you're disappointed or if you want to pay for your own parking, you can ask for your money back. And because it's a public library, they have to give it to you so you can use it to pay for the parking.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Please join us in the lobby for a book signing.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.